From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Johns Hopkins Professor of Psychiatry and Mood Disorders Kay Redfield Jamison, author of An Unquiet Mind, trains her expertise on one of the most acclaimed poets of the 20th century in her new book, Robert Lowell, Setting the River on Fire.
He was a poet of great originality. He was a poet of vastness, of starting from the new and creating the new. He was not somebody who worked in manicured phrases. He's not somebody who was unafraid to take risks.
She tells us how Lowell's manic depressive disease influenced his writing, the importance of his strength of character, and how common mania is among the creative. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. It's a gift to be able to look deeply, intimately into the workings of another's mind, especially a mind challenged with a disease that stalks millions of our fellow Americans, manic depressive illness or bipolar disorder. If it is the mind of one of the 20th century's greatest poets, an even greater gift. That's what Johns Hopkins Professor of Psychiatry and Mood Disorders Kay Redfield Jamison has given us in her new book, Robert Lowell, Setting the River on Fire, A Study of Genius, Mania, and Character. 20 years ago, in her memoir, An Unquiet Mind, Jamison gave us a new way of thinking about moods and madness. She's also written Night Falls Fast and Touched with Fire, and she's co-author of the standard medical text on manic depressive illness. Kay Redfield Jamison is with me in the studio. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Robert Trail Spence Lowell IV was just 30 years old when he won his first Pulitzer for poetry and then won another in 1974, as well as a National Book Award, a National Book Critics Award. He broke new ground in poetry. You took the title of this book, Setting the River on Fire, from a poem of his called Reading Myself. Would you read part of that for us?
Yes, of course. Reading Myself. Like thousands, I took just pride and more than just, struck matches that brought my blood to a boil. I memorized the tricks to set the river on fire. Somehow, never wrote something to go back to. Can I suppose that I am finished with wax flowers and have earned my grass on the minor slopes of Parnassus? No honeycomb is built without a bee adding circle to circle, cell to cell, the wax and honey of a mausoleum. This round dome proves its maker is alive. The corpse of the insect lives embalmed in honey, praves that its perishable work live long enough for the sweet-toothed bear to desecrate. This open book, my open coffin.
I think I understand the last line, this open book, my open coffin. But when he says, I memorized the tricks to set the river on fire, why was that the image you wanted on the cover of this
book? I wanted it because he was a poet of great originality. He was a poet of vastness, of starting from the new and creating the new. He was not somebody who worked in manicured phrases. He's not somebody who was unafraid to take risks. It's also a classical reference to the Odyssey and the river of death that is set on fire. But it, much more importantly, I think it is just he had a fiery mind, and a great mind. One of the things that was extraordinary about Lowell, I think, was what people said, not just about the fact that he wrote brilliant original poetry, but that his mind was just extraordinarily complex and interesting.
You make it clear in your introduction that this is not a biography.
Right.
What is it?
It's a study of a mind and character, of a way of going through life, and dealing with adversity, great adversity, and great privilege. He was someone who came from a very privileged background, but he's also someone who was given a bad disease and a very bad form of it, bipolar illness, and at that time called manic depressive illness. He had 20 hospitalizations for severe mania, It was very costly to him, and he was someone who studied how to deal with it. He was interested in making a life study of dealing with darkness and joy.
When did this illness first manifest itself?
When he was very young. He wasn't hospitalized until he was in his early 30s. In that time, he was, you know, very psychotic, hallucinating and delusional and so forth. Before that, when he was a child, he was just really violent temper tantrums, eccentric behavior, strange way of going through childhood, basically. Very, very cool and unaffectionate parents. But he first saw a psychiatrist when he was 15, but he certainly was disturbed before that.
That's Kay Redfield Jamison, author and professor of mood disorders and psychiatry at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Here on The Record on WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about her new book, Robert Lowell, Setting the River on Fire, A Study of Genius, Mania, and Character. You prefer the term that was used at the time he was being treated, manic depressive illness. You prefer that to bipolar disorder.
Yes.
Why?
I think it's more accurate scientifically. Bipolar disorder implies that there are these two poles, mania on one side and depression on the other side, when in fact we know that they often are in a volatile mix. We don't know enough at this point to make completely accurate distinctions between people who are only depressed and people who are both depressed and manic. So when you say bipolar, you're assuming that somebody has a history of mania. When in fact, what we know is that the more recurrent the depression is, the more it looks actually like bipolar illness. It's also much more, to me, much more descriptive. I actually think people should call themselves whatever they want to, and the doctors should use whatever phrases they want. I mean, I don't hold by it. It's a personal choice. I find bipolar a very truncated, trivializing phrase.
Trivializing?
Yeah, you know, in the sense that it kind of makes it, it's sort of like those ads on television where you just get letters for your disease, you know, AD and ED and so forth. And it makes it a little more clever and less severe than...
More manageable.
More manageable and kind of very drug company oriented. And I just find it offensive. I think, I mean, if you call yourself bipolar, you still get mania and you still get depression. So it's not like you're really avoiding that. I mean, a lot of people feel very strongly that it has helped with destigmatizing the illness, and that's great. You know, again, if people want to call themselves bipolar, and it's really kind of a done deal in this day and age. It's just from my point of view, manic depressive illness conveys both the reality of the illness and the severity of it.
You begin the book with a prologue set in 1845. Robert Lowell's great-great-grandmother, Harriet Brackett Spence Lowell, is in a carriage. What's going on?
She is leaving her beautiful home in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is now the home that's used by the presidents of Harvard as their residence. And she's leaving the home that she's been in for 30 years and taking a carriage to McLean Asylum for the Insane. And she is insane, and she will remain insane the rest of her life. And what I wanted to convey in that was partly the seriousness of what was going on and the fact that this is a genetic illness. I think when people hear genetic, it's just one of those, you know, kind of glaze over phrases in a way. And in fact, it's the relentlessness of this illness in line after line, ancestral lines. And I wanted to convey that this was all over Lowell's family. It wasn't just in her. But she also was the one he felt, her family come from the Orkney Islands in Scotland, he felt that she was the one who really brought poetry into the family line.
I want to talk to you about all these ancestors that pop up. I mean, some of them pop up in his own name.
Yes.
Do I recognize in Trail, one of his middle names? You dedicate the book to your husband, Tom Trail.
Yes, so that's right. They're quite distantly related.
Okay.
But he and Robert Lowell's daughter have talked about that quite a bit. And I think the relationship with the Trail line and the Spence line both is, again, one of great poetry and great writing. And one of the things I tried to do was draw upon the letters that were written by her ancestors, Lowell's ancestors, to show not only the disturbance in the mind, but again, that these letters are beautifully written. They're just great examples of descriptive writing of madness and of depression and melancholia.
So, I mean, he came from the Lowells and the Winslows, mm-hmm. famous families right. in New England history, and you recount Francis Cabot Lowell, for whom the city of Lowell, Massachusetts is named, Percival Lowell, who's a mathematician who founded the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, James Russell Lowell, the poet and essayist in the 19th century.
And Amy Lowell, another well-known poet and president of Harvard. Yes, a very long family line of people.
But you give me the impression this was not name-dropping for him, that his ancestors were an important part of his identity.
Oh, for sure. I don't think, as a matter of fact, I think he went a long way in his life to try and avoid dropping names because it was a source of envy, creating envy, and it was not something that he was comfortable doing. But he lived in history. So when he became delusional, for example, he not only experienced Achilles, he was Achilles, okay? He was known by his friends and by his students as someone who lived in the past in a way in which, if he talked about Tennyson in his poetry classes at Harvard, he talked about Tennyson as if he and Tennyson were in the same room together and were great friends. He had incredible imagination and incredible historical imagination, and historians who knew him and classicists who knew him commented on the fact that he just had this one-of-a-kind historical imagination. When he became manic, this went even further. So he would become Achilles or Alexander the Great or Dante or T.S. Eliot, a wide variety of people. And so his ancestors were one part of that. He studied his ancestors, and actually one of his psychiatrists very early on in treatment suggested that he study his ancestors to try and understand himself better. And he got very caught up in that, and his most famous book, Life Studies, revolves around many of those ancestors and was, again, at the suggestion of his psychiatrist.
Again and again, you come back to this question of character, his faculty for regeneration. Explain mm-hmm. that.
I think it's very hard for people who don't have a history of psychosis, of having completely lost their minds, to appreciate how difficult it is to get back into life and to get back into society, to get back into your profession. And so Lowell would, for example, teach one of his classes, poetry classes at Harvard. And every year, in his students, he had a reputation of getting manic and having to be carted off to McLean Hospital. And so he had to live with this reputation. Then it would happen. And he would have to then come back and teach. You know, so I'm always intrigued by the part of that that is he came back to teach. You know, people show up again at work. They show up again in their families, and it's not easy. And Lowell was somebody who, from the time he was a child, he had heroes. He had the exemplars in his life whom he studied for character and courage. So that, you know, like Lord Moran said, you know, courage is something that's a conscious decision. Lowell made conscious decisions to tough it out, to go on. And not everybody can do that, but I think it's incredibly interesting when people can do that.
Kay Redfield Jamison is staying with us. We're talking about her new book, A Deep Psychological Profile of the Poet Robert Lowell. She'll be speaking about it Thursday evening at the Johns Hopkins Barnes & Noble. We've got information at the On the Record page on WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Quick break, right back.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking today with author Kay Redfield Jamerson, professor of mood disorders and psychiatry at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. We're talking about her new book, Robert Lowell, Setting the River on Fire, a study of genius, mania, and character, a psychological study of the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, of Lord Wyrie's Castle and life studies and many, many others. You write that it would be worth studying Robert Lowell just for Lowell, but that is even more worth doing because mania is part of the lives of so many other writers and creators. Tell us more about that connection.
It's a connection that is long observed for thousands of years, which, of course, doesn't make it right. It just makes it an observation. It's a controversial one. I mean, some people regard it as reductionist to say, you know, that because a writer or an artist had mental illness, that was somehow is a pejorative, which I think reflects more a social attitude than it does reality. I mean, people get illnesses, and artists and writers in a lot of studies, an awful lot of studies, have been shown to have a disproportionate rate of bipolar illness. I mean, most people who are creative don't have mental illness, and most people who have mental illness are not creative. It's rather that there is a disproportionate rate of bipolar illness in very highly creative and imaginative writers and artists. And as I say, it's been studied for many, many years, and more recently in the last 10 years, very, very large-scale population studies of 30, 40, 50,000 people, up to 1.5 million people, looking at the relationship between creative occupation and psychiatric hospitalizations and so forth. And it seems almost always to be bipolar illness, not other kinds of mental illness.
Well, you've looked deeply into Robert Lowell. You had access to his medical records, so you've looked deeper in some ways than any other writer has. Did Lowell's mental illness make him a great poet, or was he a great poet in spite of it?
I think a bit of both. He certainly was a great poet, I think, in spite of it. I mean, I don't think you take somebody who has a non-poetic mind or a non-genius mind, give them mania and make them into a genius or make them creative. That it doesn't work that way. I think in the case of Lowell, and I think what Lowell talked about with his doctors on many occasions and his doctors observed, is that it made his work different, a different kind of work, so that that incredibly vast, interesting mind that was packed with experience and observation and feeling and analytic capacity and intuitive capacity, that when that was hit by mania, it shook the moorings and made him create and generate in a different sort of way. So he described to his doctors, and it's very clear from the pattern in his writings, that he would start to get manic, and as he escalated into mania, he would generate a lot of ideas and a lot of words and a lot of phrases, and these would just come out in sheets and sheets and sheets of paper. And if he was in the hospital, they would be in sheets of paper on the floor, and anybody visiting him would just see these mounds of fragments of things. Most of that was not helpful or useful to his work, but out of it, he got some ideas and some images that he took and worked on and worked on and worked on. And coming back to the notion of character, he worked really hard. I mean, he worked from the beginning of the day till the end of the day, and he just didn't stop. The poetry didn't just come from nowhere. So he would have these images that were generated in mania, and then when he was depressed, because each of his manias was followed by months of depression, he would work and obsess and ruminate, and then when he was normal, he'd do the same thing. So it was the generation of ideas and originality during the mania that was important.
You tallied up the best you could near the end of the book. You said 16 times.
Yes, it was more than 16 times. He said that to a friend, this was long, considerably before the end of his life, he said 16 times, "I've been down on my knees in madness, and 16 times I've come up again." But that was before. He actually was hospitalized 20 times for mania.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Johns Hopkins Professor of Psychiatry and Mood Disorders, Kay Redfield Jamerson. We're discussing her new book, Robert Lowell, Setting the River on Fire, A Study of Genius, Mania, and Character. You write that in 1949, ECT, electroconvulsive therapy or electric shock, was the only treatment available for mania.
Yes. Well, hospitalization was available, and we don't think of hospitalization as a treatment, but it actually was quite protective to him. And over the years, he began to appreciate the fact that it kept him from doing more harm to himself and more harm to other people than he already was doing when he was manic. So hospitalization was there, and hydrotherapy, I mean, kind of a lot of hosing down with water was available. But what worked very well for him and still is a very effective treatment for acute mania is shock treatment. It was in a more primitive form there then, but he responded. It was the only thing that turned his mania around and helped him to get well. The problem with shock treatment is that it doesn't prevent future episodes. So even though he got out of the hospital, got well, he then got sick again.
And that was part of the pain for him, was the dread of another episode, of another mania, another depression.
The terror of it. And again, it's one of the things that was most poignant, incredibly sad, in reading his medical records. I mean, most of his medical records read like medical records of anyone who has mania or bipolar illness and depression who's in a hospital because of the severity of it. It's a typical charts. But what's particularly poignant is the ability to articulate his terror of becoming manic again. Because ordinarily, when he was well, he was gentle, he was kind, he was generous, people loved him. When he became manic, he was abusive and violent and terrible.
And so, when he's 40, and you find the medical record where a psychiatrist who's admitting him into a hospital writes that he had, quote, an undue preoccupation with greatness, almost a sense of mission. He had a great need to be not only good but unique among poets, close quote. I mean, how much of that was the real Robert Lowell, who'd been given every great educational opportunity and knew he was smart and knew he had a fabulous classical background? I mean, how much was that justified self-confidence, and how much was, as the psychiatrist read it, a preoccupation with greatness that was somehow not
normal? Well, I think
it's
very hard.
Normal.
I mean, I mean, a lot of people have great educations and privilege and aren't particularly confident people, you know. It's confidence and assuredness, which is probably more of what Lowell had, that assuredness, that capacity to risk and create and deviate. I think that, you know, it's probably a thin line. And I think that when he became manic, and he was in the hospital at the time his doctor was observing this, and she observed that it was a preoccupation. Well, at that point, it was of delusional extent. So, you know, he was T.S. Eliot or whomever he was, or Dante. I think it was, she was talking about his being Dante at the time, that he really thought he could be, and indeed he thought he was Dante, you know, and he would sit on the ward and revise Dante, and he would revise T.S. Eliot's Wasteland and so forth. So the line between being assured enough to take on the challenge of writing unbelievably original, extraordinary poetry, and moving down the line into mania, into delusional proportions, is perhaps not as wide as one might think. I think what really differentiated him was the delusional, that he really at some point thought he was Dante, not just that he could write like Dante.
Robert Lowell was just 60 when he died, and he seemed to feel it was coming for months, maybe mm-hmm. years. What led to his death?
Heart disease. He had bad heart disease that he was being treated for. He died quite suddenly. It was also in the midst of unbelievable personal turmoil. He was leaving his third wife to go back to his second wife. He was suffering from an unbelievable psychological pain from that. He was very much in love with his third wife, and it was nothing but chaos and anger and despair and fights and love. And he was going back to his second wife, whom he had a 20-year marriage and a daughter, but didn't have the passion. And he was going back to that. He smoked a lot. He drank quite a bit. And he had a disease that's actually associated with an increased risk for heart disease. So.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. I mean, did his madness hasten his death?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think that if you look at the average, untreated bipolar illness is results in people dying 15 to 20 years younger. Now, some of that's suicide. Some of that's increased risk of heart disease. Some of that's poor nutrition, poor access to medical care. There are a lot of reasons for it, but there are quite a few studies that show increased rate of heart disease.
Congratulations on this book.
Thank you.
And thank you for telling us about it. Kay Redfield Jamison's new book is Robert Lowell, Setting the River on Fire, a study of genius, mania, and character. She'll be discussing it Thursday, 7 p.m. at the Barnes & Noble in the 3300 block of St. Paul Street near Johns Hopkins campus. We've got information at the On the Record page at wypr.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.